Ordered to leave Russia today, Wednesday, August 6th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The American wife of a prominent human rights lawyer in St. Petersburg is served with an expulsion order. She says the anti-American climate in Russia started with the turmoil in Ukraine.
That was really the beginning of what I felt was a very cold and cooling period, and frankly, it's just become cooler and cooler.
Also today, why that wave of unaccompanied minors from Central America does not include many kids from Nicaragua. One big reason, a relatively low crime rate in the country, something this Nicaraguan woman now in California can attest to.
Well, where I'm from, there's not that much crime. I'm from the province. I'm not from the capital.
Plus, a fiddler's quest to learn the full history of his instrument, and he does. The stories and more after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. Back in 1978, this is what the world looked like. Jimmy Carter was president. That summer, two popes died in quick succession, and John Paul II became pontiff. And in Argentina, the dirty war was taking place. That's when a boy was born in a military hospital there. His mother gave birth in captivity after being abducted by Argentina's military for opposing the ruling junta. She was shot dead 2 months later, and her newborn son was secretly given to others for adoption. There were hundreds of cases like that. But here's the twist. That boy, now a man of 36, has just been reunited with his grandmother. Estela Di Carlotto is her name, and for decades she's been at the forefront of the search for the missing in Argentina as founder and president of the Grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo. That's a group dedicated to finding the stolen babies of the disappeared from the dirty war. Our BBC Mundo colleague Ignacio de los Reyes is in Buenos Aires. He says the newly identified grandson was born Guido Carlotto, but grew up with a different identity.
His name until now was Ignacio, and he's a musician. He was raised by a family of peasants in a very small town near Buenos Aires, and all of a sudden he discovered that he was the grandson of one of the most famous people in Argentina.
Ignacio, for our listeners who don't understand or remember why these kids disappeared 40 years ago and why they only have grandparents, remind us of what happened during Argentina's dirty war that meant children were stolen from their families.
It all began in the 70s. There was a coup d'etat in 76 in Argentina where a military junta took power. And then they decided to go after all the left-wing militants that were trying to fight against the military government. And many of these left-wing activists gave birth at detention centers or at military facilities. And those babies were taken away from their mothers. Laura, who was Estela de Carlotto's daughter, gave birth at a detention center. And only 5 hours after she gave birth, her baby, Guido, was taken away. She was killed right after that. So Estela de Carlotto did know that Laura had a baby, but she couldn't even see his face. So she's been wandering for nearly 4 decades, writing letters in newspapers. Every year she wrote to her grandchild, trying to imagine how he looked like. And actually, when you see his pictures that are everywhere around Argentine media, you can really see how he looked like his parents.
So De Carlotto's grandson was the 114th disappeared child now found. How many stolen children are still out there?
It's really difficult to know because even though human rights organizations believe there could be hundreds, it's even difficult to say how many people were killed or disappeared during those years. There are some estimates that say that nearly 30,000 people were killed. But because this was a very brutal regime, one of their plans was also to get rid of the bodies, so the families would never know the truth about the fate of all these left-wing activists. Many people were actually thrown from planes or helicopters to the River Plate, so their bodies would never be recovered.
For you, Ignacio, I mean, you're practically the same age as Guido de Carlotto. I imagine some of your friends in Argentina are. Have you spoken to them about what this whole event means?
I have friends that are in their 30s or early 40s, and some of them tell me that, well, because they were born under this dictatorship. They told me that some of them even have had doubts about their own identity. One of my friends told me that she once asked her mother to show her a picture of when she was pregnant, just to prove that she was actually her biological daughter. So this is a very, very sensitive issue in Argentina that has marked a whole generation. And even some of the grandchildren that have regained their real identity, they thought they had a family, and all of a sudden they realized they actually had two. And in some cases, they had to choose.
The BBC Mundo's Ignacio de los Reyes in Buenos Aires. Thanks very much for filling us in on the story.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Now to a story we've been covering a lot, also about a whole generation of kids. The wave of unaccompanied children from Central America. The U.S. Border Patrol says it's apprehended almost 60,000 of these kids since October, most from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Curiously, very few of them are from Central America's poorest country, Nicaragua. Jill Replogle of KPBS in San Diego wanted to know why.
In the theater of Sacred Heart Cathedral Prep School in San Francisco, a Nicaraguan folk dance group rehearses for an upcoming performance. Maria Caldera watches her two little girls twirl across the stage in long, colorful skirts. Caldera came here when she was just a girl. When she can, she visits her extended family who still live in Nicaragua.
Well, where I'm from, there's not that much crime because I'm from the province. I'm not from the capital. So we still live very old-fashioned.
Even Nicaragua's capital, Managua, is pretty safe compared to other Central American cities. Overall, Nicaragua's murder rate is far lower than that of El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras. Ev Mead says that's a big reason why few Nicaraguan children make the dangerous journey across Mexico to the United States. Mead directs the Transborder Institute at the University of San Diego.
And I think a lot of that is just, you know, they're not facing the kind of social violence. I think it's that simple.
Plus, the migrant experience has been different for Nicaraguans than for other Central Americans. To understand why, we need to look at how history's unfolded in the region. Civil wars ravaged El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua in the 1980s, and refugees flocked to the U.S. from all three countries. But in the case of Nicaragua, the U.S. backed the rebels fighting against the socialist Sandinista government and welcomed dissidents. It's similar to how we still treat Cubans.
There were special provisions made in the law for Nicaraguans because they were fleeing an enemy of the United States.
Today, more Nicaraguans have become permanent residents and U.S. citizens than other Central Americans. They're less likely to be deported, and they can more easily bring family members to the U.S. legally.
And thus, they didn't suffer this sort of cycle of deportation and return that Guatemalans and Salvadorans did.
The U.S. has deported tens of thousands of Salvadorans, Guatemalans, and Hondurans in the past two decades. Families have been divided, and some immigrants who made gang affiliations in the U.S. took those criminal pasts back with them to Central America, helping transform those gangs into transnational crime rings. Violent gangs have become increasingly powerful in places like San Salvador, but they've never taken hold in Nicaragua. The lack of criminal deportees there is one factor, but observers also give credit to the country's generally upstanding police force and its focus on prevention.
The police have really been very active for a long time at identifying who these kids are that are at risk or are involved in neighborhood gangs and approaching them, making an effort to integrate these kids back into society.
Tim Rogers is editor of the Nicaragua Dispatch, an online news site. He says this is a very different approach than the heavy-handed gang crackdowns that the governments of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras have tried in recent years.
Nicaragua has moved away from that. So the proof is in the pudding that it's working.
This travel agency in San Francisco's Mission District does a brisk business, booking tickets for Nicaraguan immigrants planning visits to the homeland. Edwin Huete goes back every year.
I go to Granada, go to Masaya, go to Estelí.
Huete fled to the U.S. 25 years ago after the Sandinista government threw him in jail for joining the U.S.-supported Contra rebels. Now the Sandinistas are back in power. And while Huete thinks the government keeps an overly tight watch on its citizens, he admits that Nicaragua today is a lot safer than its neighbors.
Between Nicaragua and Salvadorian Honduras, Guatemala, I prefer to live in Nicaragua.
Now, to be sure, Nicaragua is not immune to emigration, but most Nicaraguans who leave are fleeing poverty, not violence. Back at the rehearsal in San Francisco, Maria Caldera says she's happy that her kids maintain a cultural connection to Nicaragua through dance and relationships with relatives who still live there. Caldera says when she talks with her uncles and cousins in Nicaragua, even though they're poor, like no indoor bathrooms poor, they say they don't plan on leaving.
They try to make a living out there, and we tell them, you want to come over here? And they're like, no, we're fine here right now.
For The World, I'm Jill Replogle in San Diego.
Grace Rubenstein contributed to that story from San Francisco. Unlike Nicaragua, other Central American nations are still sending a wave of unaccompanied minors north to the U.S. You can ask your questions about the child migrant crisis on our Facebook page. We have a live Q&A happening right now at facebook.com/PRI the world. In Gaza, day two of the ceasefire. This time it seems to be holding. And now both Israelis and Palestinians face the difficult task of negotiating a lasting truce. One step at a time, there are lots of thorny issues to consider. Even the smallest details could potentially derail an accord. Reconstruction, for example. If Gaza is to rebuild after these weeks of devastation, it'll require cement. But cement can also be used by militants to rebuild the tunnels the Israeli military just destroyed. Rob Bletcher is with the International Crisis Group. And Rob, let's talk cement in just a moment. But first, why are these tunnels, remind us, such a big deal for Israel?
Well, the tunnels have been used to launch attacks against Israel. Ever since 2006, the tunnels have been a threat. And you've been able to see that most clearly in the recent war when they were used both defensively by Hamas, that is to say, against Israeli soldiers coming into Gaza, but also offensively by Hamas, with the tunnels passing under their border, with Hamas popping up into Israeli territory with intent to attack.
It seems, though, Israel's big concern is that Hamas would take the cement and immediately start to rebuild the tunnels. How was the cement issue managed in the past?
Well, it's been handled in a couple different ways. You know, for a substantial period of time, there were no building materials allowed into Gaza. For a different period of time, the cement was allowed in only under the auspices of the UN, and the UN was responsible for tracking that cement and making sure it was used for its intended purpose. Yeah. Then during another period, the tunnels under the border with Egypt, that was the main thoroughfare for cement coming in.
If there are no tunnels now, Israel has said mission accomplished on getting rid of the tunnels, how would cement even get in? Israel would presumably have to allow it.
Well, I know. I just need to clarify that we're talking about two different kinds of tunnels here, and it's very important to have the distinction.
Okay, make that distinction.
So one kind of tunnel is the kind of tunnel that everybody was talking about during the recent fighting, which are the tunnels that went under the border between Israel and Gaza. And these tunnels were used for military purposes. There's a second kind of tunnel, which has long existed. And those are the kinds of tunnels that go between Gaza and Egypt. And these tunnels were very active until about a year ago, after Morsi was deposed and after Sisi came in. He cracked down on these tunnels under Egypt's border with Gaza. So I think what's going to have to happen now, because the tunnels under the border with Egypt, between Gaza and Egypt, no longer exist or have been blocked, or at least just about entirely blocked, the concrete will have to come in legitimately overground. And I think that's why getting this ceasefire is so much more difficult than ceasefires in the past. Because if you look back to 2012, if the official ceasefire agreement was not implemented, there was always a safety valve. The tunnels under the border with Egypt were the safety valve. Now you're in a situation where that safety valve doesn't exist anymore. So if the official ceasefire does not work, you're very quickly going to find yourself back in the exact same situation which led to this escalation last month.
Wow. Before this interview, I thought cement was just a sidebar to the Gaza story, but it sounds like you're saying it's critical and a potential deal breaker.
I think that there are three things that are really crucial, three goods that are really crucial to creating a semblance of normality in Gaza. One is building materials, which includes cement. There's fuel and there's electricity. And there are grave problems with fuel and electricity as well. And unless those three things are normalized such that the people of Gaza can regain a semblance of a normal life, I think the ceasefire is going to last for less time rather than more time.
Rob Bletcher, Acting Director of Middle East and North Africa Programs at the International Crisis Group. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up on The World, lights, camera, Soviet physics on PRI. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Endangered species are a big business. The illegal global trade in protected animal and plant products is likely well into the tens of billions of dollars, and that is a lot of crime. But to help get to the bottom of it, there's only one top-notch forensics laboratory for wildlife in the world, and it's here in the U.S. Here's reporter Murray Carpenter.
At the International Mail Facility at New York's JFK Airport, an inspector is opening a box that's been flagged as suspicious. The inspector, whose name we're not using due to the sensitive nature of his work, reaches inside and pulls out a zebra skin. It's a fairly typical find for this U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employee, barely worth batting an eyelash over compared to some of what he and his colleagues see.
One of the most weird things I saw here was a big box full of millipedes and scorpions and spiders, and there was one of those holy cow moments.
That's the inspector's supervisor, Naima Aziz. She says some of those creatures may have been protected species. But the inspector quickly determines that today's find is not contraband.
So this is a skin of a regular Burchell zebra. And you can determine the difference between the Burchell zebra and, let's say, for protected species zebra, which is the Hartman zebra, based on the stripe patterns on the skin of the zebra.
For trickier ID questions, though, the inspectors often pack up suspicious samples and ship them across country to a lab in the hills of southern Oregon.
We're going into a locked storage area within the evidence control area. So this is like the third level of security where we put valuable things.
That's Ken Goddard, who directs the Fish and Wildlife Service's forensic lab. It's basically a CSI unit for wildlife crime, and it's the only one in the whole world. Deputy Director Ed Espinoza says most folks have no idea what goes on here.
Most people believe that we're protecting deer and fish.
But Espinoza says the lab now takes on cases that can originate thousands of miles away.
A lot of the stuff we end up doing are major types of crime, international trade, very high value, rhino horn, ivory, endangered woods.
What we have here is four of the original 74 tusks that we got in a attempt to smuggle ivory from Africa to China.
Ken Goddard pulls one of the tusks off a shelf in the vault. He says along with investigating domestic poaching, the lab supports big international efforts, like the one trying to figure out where these tusks came from and who might have been responsible.
These animals were probably shot from the air. We can see the impact marks of the bullets in a downward direction.
After shooting the elephants, likely from helicopters, the poachers buried the tusks to hide them. That left some soil residue.
We used trace evidence techniques, getting at the soil that was inside the tusks and isolating the pollen, the insect parts, and other minerals. And it was really a process of elimination. So we started from the planet and worked our way down to a relatively narrow area across three countries.
To do this kind of sophisticated analysis, the scientists here use some of the latest CSI techniques, like this direct analysis real-time spectrometer. It sounds like a mini jet engine, but the machine blows a stream of helium at 800 degrees Fahrenheit at whatever material is being analyzed. Espinoza says the spectrometer can quickly identify many substances that might otherwise be impossible to trace, like a sample of tropical hardwood.
It has no morphological features. It doesn't have a leaf. So in many cases, this is the only way currently of getting identification in some of these samples.
The machine comes in handy in situations like the 2011 case when the Fish and Wildlife Service challenged Gibson Guitar over illegal imports of ebony and rosewood from India and Madagascar. To help crack their cases, the lab also keeps a library of 25,000 samples of DNA in what looks like a row of refrigerators.
The temperature is minus 70 degrees Celsius, which is roughly minus 100 Fahrenheit, which is seriously cold. But that's going to keep those samples usable for probably 50, 60, 70 years.
It was DNA that catalyzed the lab in the first place. Back in the 1980s, an Oregon resident was surprised to learn that the Fish and Wildlife Service couldn't analyze DNA. He began lobbying the state's U.S. senators to build a lab, and it finally opened in 1989. Along with its work here in Ashland, the lab's experts conduct trainings all over the country and the world to help wildlife agents like those inspectors at JFK identify illicit animal parts. Goddard says it all adds up to a lot of work.
We're trying to be the crime lab for 172 countries. It's not doable, but we try. We're their laboratory, and we're trying to make a difference.
And in many cases, they are. In one recent operation, work here helped bring down an international criminal network that smuggled dozens of horns from critically endangered rhinos. For The World, I'm Murray Carpenter, Ashland, Oregon.
Speaking of wildlife, have you ever been jolted out of bed by this sound early on a Saturday morning? Ugh. Would you prefer this instead? Nice. In England, residents of Havering, just outside London, will be hearing more of the latter. That's because the town council has turned to cows instead of lawnmowers to keep parks and other green spaces neat and trim. The council estimates the move will save about $500,000 over 10 years. Roger Beecroft is the guy in charge of this new grazing program. Yeah, this is a grass management strategy that goes back even centuries. How'd you come up with this idea?
Well, absolutely. It's not new. I mean, these meadows are interesting because they've been grazed in the past. And what's happened, it's been managed other ways or not managed at all. And they've started losing some of their wildlife interest. So going back to the traditional management, and particularly using traditional breeds, which have been selected to do well on these areas, is exactly what we've been doing and what many people are interested in now.
What kind of cows are you using for this? I mean, can you use any old cow?
Well, our breed is a red poll cattle, which was bred in the late 1800s for use on exactly these sort of areas.
So will this work for these cattle, kind of spare them the slaughterhouse?
No, absolutely not. No, these cattle, they're a commercial herd as well. And the steers will eventually go to the butchers. They are slow growing and eating a whole variety of food. The meat quality is fantastic.
Free range cattle with a dual purpose.
Absolutely. So that the flavor of these animals comes from what they've been eating and what grassland with a whole mixture of different species and herbs amongst it provides some fantastic eating meat at the end.
What other benefits do you get from using cows to keep the lawns well trimmed?
When they're grazing, they'll take different species at different times to get a variety of height and different structure within the meadows. And a lot of the wildlife likes that. So if it's all at one constant height, for instance, if you're mowing, you cut it once and take lots of stuff away, and the habitat changes dramatically, instantly. And with cattle grazing, it's a slow process, and the wildlife with the meadows can move around, and a lot of the wildlife will thrive. So going back to traditional methods, goes back to the days when there's lots of wildlife in the meadows.
Right, and you don't get those benefits from lawnmowers, but what you do get is a pretty even and tidy cut.
Yeah, so I mean, the even cut from a wildlife point of view is pretty horrific, really. So it's interesting how different people view these areas. If I go and look at a meadow with lots of wildflowers in it and some cattle grazing it and people enjoying it all, I think it's fantastic. Whereas other people go to a bit of grass and have it looking like a lawn and they think that's fantastic. So it's a question of perception, really, but some of these areas that traditionally have been good for wildlife need a different management for mowing.
Lawnmowers release gasoline fumes. Cows release manure, of course. Who's going to clean that up?
Well, the insects clean it up automatically. There's lots of insects, things like dung beetles. So there's no need to go around and clear up after the cows. It's all part of the natural process.
Do you think this could become a trend?
Yes. I mean, there is more and more interest in it. We're being asked by various conservation organizations to help in grazing various areas. So it's really quite fun doing it and taking people along on the journey, really.
Roger Beecroft telling us about his cows that keep the grass short and tidy around Havering in England. Good luck with this.
Thank you very much.
This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, recreating the Soviet Union on film in Ukraine. And the cast includes former Soviet party bosses and spies and this scientist.
The scale of this whole project is totally mind-boggling. Like, they closed the airport and they changed the signs from Ukrainian to Russian.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity.com. Personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Russia doesn't seem to care what we in the West think of it. The Russian government, I mean. Just look at the Kremlin's ongoing crackdown on human rights activists and non-governmental organizations, a crackdown that many in the West have condemned to no apparent effect in Moscow. The latest example is the case of Jennifer Gaspar. She's the American wife of the prominent Russian human rights lawyer Ivan Pavlov. She's lived in Russia for 10 years working for various NGOs, But yesterday, Gaspar got a letter labeling her a national security threat and ordering her to leave the country. Gaspar and Pavlov spoke to me from their St. Petersburg home. I asked her what legal weight that letter carried.
I think, as far as I can tell, the heaviest weight possible of any deportation order. It's quite serious, and it has to be observed, and I have to leave, or I have to appeal through the court system.
Right, and if you didn't do either of those, they would put you in jail?
Or escort me to the nearest airport. I'm not quite sure what the process is, and I hope not to find out. Maybe Ivan's a better person to answer that.
It's not very clear in our legislation, and now status of Jennifer is also unclear. We apply to the court, but we expecting decision about this maybe on the beginning of next week.
Jennifer, why is this happening to you? I mean, what were you doing that merited the Russian government saying you're a threat to national security?
That's a question we've been asking ourselves quite a bit. I've worked with organizations ranging from children's charities to cultural organizations to groups working with people living with HIV and AIDS to, yes, human rights groups. But quite honestly, it's hard for me to fathom how the work that I've been doing in trying to help organizations become better managed, become more open and accountable to the public, to their donors, how that would constitute a threat to Russia's national security.
Were you working on any highly sensitive cases or any high-profile individuals recently?
No. I've been working with the State Hermitage Museum, which I'm helping them raise money for their contemporary arts collection. I've been working with a group in Prague on reporting for accountability and legal defense for NGOs. But I've also been working on governance issues for children's charities and fundraising. And it's really quite a mixed bag because I wear many hats.
Ivan Pavlov, what's going on here? I mean, you're a human rights lawyer. Do you think this is kind of guilt by association?
You know, I think it's like Jennifer calls it ideal storm, when all circumstances happened in one place in the same time. Like Jennifer is, you know, has American citizenship.
Okay.
I am a human rights lawyer with a 20 years practice in Russia and took part in high profile cases here. So, and maybe it's like a, not vendetta, how to say it's, you know, to punish some American citizenship, like an anti-sanction activity of the, it's like a, to put a, you know, Star of David on an armband.
You've also got some urgent family considerations to deal with, too. You have a 5-year-old daughter, the two of you. What's going to happen to her?
Well, we stay together.
The three of you?
Yes.
So you're either all three staying in Russia or you're all leaving together?
Yes.
Yeah, it's not an issue for us.
No, not a question. And the idea of being separated by my family with such an absurd accusation, I mean, there's no other choice but to fight this.
Wouldn't it just be easier for the three of you, since you've got family back here in the U.S., Jennifer, to return to the U.S.?
It's always an option, and we're very grateful that that's an option. But what we feel very strongly is not an option right now, particularly with, you know, with Ivan's work and what's happening in Russia, that we want to be close enough. We want to be able to go back and forth just so that he can keep running and doing the work that he's been doing. It's not quite as easy to do that from the U.S.
Where would you be able to do that? That would put you in proximity to Russia.
We're looking at a few options right now. I mean, certainly, you know, we're in St. Petersburg, which is very close to many Baltic states and Eastern Europe, and we're discussing all of the possible eventualities.
Jennifer Gaspar and her husband Ivan Pavlov, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here's another news story from Russia that we should all be worried about. A gang of Russian hackers has amassed more than a billion username and password combinations from a wide variety of websites. This is considered to be the largest collection ever of stolen internet data, and the hackers are getting more brazen.
In a break from similar Russian hack attacks in the past, these guys weren't afraid to go after Russian sites as well.
That's David Gallus from the New York Times. He helped break the story about this latest virtual heist by Russian hackers.
It was just an astonishing number that took a moment to get our head around, frankly. 1.2 billion unique username and password combinations, 500 million unique email addresses, culled from 420,000 or more individual websites, is simply larger than any other breach we've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds industrial in nature, and yet this is being attributed to a Russian hacker gang. Who are they?
As far as we know, this is a group of fewer than a dozen young men, mostly in their 20s, all whom know one another personally, not just virtually, and who are operating out of a small town in south-central Russia, the region flanked by Kazakhstan and Mongolia. And the fact that a small group like this was able to seemingly inflict such widespread damage just goes to show how weak most companies' security measures are.
Right. You said companies. So who were they targeting? Were they targeting the minnows, like users like you and me, or were they kind of targeting bigger fish?
So the way this worked is that they actually went to this hundreds of thousands of websites and extracted the data from their databases. So in this case, the ones at fault are really the companies and organizations that have too weak security on their sites. And the victims are you and I, people who trusted these organizations and companies with our data and who simply just were not secured by them.
So if you're one of these users on one of these sites who changes their passwords regularly, you would have been affected anyway.
They have passwords stretching back for years, and they also have very recent data, according to security experts outside the firm who we consulted to verify the data. So this is an enormous trove. And listen, updating your passwords regularly helps, but even then, the scale of this breach is so unprecedented, it's hard to say that anyone's username and password is really secure at this point.
So can you just give us a few of the sites that they hacked?
Unfortunately, we don't have the full list. Hold Security, the group that uncovered this, understandably wanted to keep that information private for now at least, because these sites are still vulnerable. So if they came out and said Company X was attacked by these guys, that would be a red flag for every other hacker that says, oh, these guys have such lax security, why don't we go there and get them too?
David, I feel like anecdotally, whenever I hear about these hacks, quite often it's from these hackers in Russia. Are these hacker groups common there, and do they get kind of a free pass to function in places like Russia?
They're very common there, and as for a free pass, I don't know if they have a free pass, but I think it's not a stretch to say that the Russian government does not have a great record of tracking these guys down and prosecuting them.
Yeah, let me take that a step further. Do you see this possibly as a form of cyber war? Is there anything to suggest that the Russian government was behind this?
The guys who uncovered this specifically said that there's no evidence that the Russian government was involved with this or has sanctioned this. So I think we don't want to make any suggestions to that effect.
You know, it really feels like keeping personal information out of the hands of thieves is like whack-a-mole. You nail one, but they just go somewhere else along with, it seems, hundreds of others. Is the decentralized nature of the net just our worst enemy?
Well, I think what you said is absolutely right. It's whack-a-mole now, and that is prompting security experts to call for something other than the username and password as kind of the main security mechanism. There's a lot of work being done in biometrics, and the truth is we're in this limbo phase where username and password combinations are clearly insecure, and yet we don't have the technology widespread enough to have a more secure method that's easily deployable just yet. So I think we're going to see more of these in the years to come.
You know, just kind of on the news you can use front, we hear that to best protect ourselves, we should change our passwords on a regular basis. I mean, you said that this hack goes back years and, you know, lots of passwords that people have had and changed. I mean, I guess the logic that passwords are harder to hack if you're a moving target, but what if you change your password on like Monday and on Tuesday there's a hack? I wouldn't still benefit from the password change, would I?
Not at all. You would have to change it again on Wednesday. And this is exactly why people feel like the system itself needs some fundamental rethinking.
David Gelis with The New York Times, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Russian hacking underworld sounds like some upcoming James Bond caper. Our next story is about an actual movie about the Nobel Prize-winning Soviet physicist Lev Landau. The film is called Dao, and there isn't a film yet about the making of Dao, but there ought to be. Dow was filmed over 5 years in a specially built two-scale replica of a 1950s Soviet scientific institute. The director even flew in real-life physicists to Ukraine for a week to play scientists in the movie. Among them was Alexander Vilenkin, the father of the world's friend and writer Alina Simone.
In July of 2011, my dad called to tell me he was returning to Kharkiv, Ukraine, the city my family left as political refugees almost 40 years ago. And he was leaving in 2 days. That wasn't even the weird part. He was going back in time, to a country that no longer exists, to play a role in what might just be the grandest experiment in film history. As my dad explains,
the scale of this whole project is totally mind-boggling. Like, they closed the main street of Kharkov for 2 days, or they closed the airport, and they changed the signs from Ukrainian to Russian. They were shooting a scene where hungry people ate some rotten cabbage, so they brought 70 tons of cabbage and they sprayed it with cement to make it look rotten.
His friend and fellow physicist Igor Klebanov also grew up in Kharkov, and like my dad, this was his first time back. The set of Dow turned out to be less than a mile from his old home.
It was kind of touching. I mean, just the fact that I knew the area and I could see our neighborhood from the windows of the studio. In some strange sense, I was the local there, and they weren't, because almost all the people at the studio were from Moscow or St. Petersburg. So there was this peculiar element of that.
Then there was the going back in time element.
You couldn't get into the territory where they were filming with any object made after 1956, because 1956 was the year they were filming, so everything had to go. So I was given underwear, I was given a briefcase.
Except for the three lead roles, everyone who participated in the filming of Dow played their own doppelganger. Physicists played physicists, Communist Party bosses played Communist Party bosses, and former KGB agents played, you guessed it.
This was like nothing else that I saw before. Inside there was like a yard, and some KGB person would walk around the perimeter. And the music, there was always music, and it was kind of threatening music, which kind of suggested some approaching catastrophe. Obviously, all that was kind of intended to press on your psyche.
It probably presses on your psyche even more if you'd once been blacklisted by the KGB, as my dad had, and spent years as a persona non grata in his own hometown. Igor, on the other hand, left Kharkiv as a teenager. For him, this was a walk on the dark side of communism he never knew.
And then when I went in, they took me to Pervoy Otdel, basically the KGB, and they had me write out these long statements in Russian using ink pen. And that was quite an experience, having this guy who is like the KGB guy basically stare at you and dictate to you, and then you're supposed to repeat it and write it all out.
Yeah, I had to do that too. And I remember that, you know, the meaning was that I will not really tell any secrets under no circumstances.
That's right, that's right. Maybe they'll be after us soon. The whole thing, I didn't perceive it as a particularly Soviet. I mean, it was an allegory of Soviet life, but my immediate impression was that the Soviet life was far more bleak than what they created at this institute.
Я по свету немало хаживал, жил землян, где в окопах тайге.
Sadly, it doesn't look like I'll ever get the chance to see my dad navigating this weird parallel universe. Dow has been scheduled to premiere at Cannes for the past 3 years in a row, but remains stuck in post-production. At least my dad brought home some souvenirs.
I understand that was the custom when a scientist visited the institute. When he left, he was given some presents, and I left most of them, but I took a roll of toilet paper, which was a very kind of nostalgic thing, which was a deficit when I lived in Kharkov, very hard to get. But I got that. It still decorates my house.
Now you know what you get when your dad goes back in time, back to the USSR. A roll of toilet paper. There's got to be some symbolism there. For the World, this is Alina Simone.
Really back in the USSR, yep. You're tuned to the world on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. I know it's hurricane season, but double hurricane season? People in Hawaii are bracing themselves for not one, but two hurricanes heading their way. Izelle is the name of the first storm that could hit the islands as early as tomorrow. Not far behind is Julio, which is upgraded to hurricane status today. It's forecast to cause trouble in Hawaii in 3 or 4 days. Residents of the Aloha State are scrambling to make the necessary preparations that we're so used to seeing along the East Coast, like boarding up the windows, stocking up on essential goods. Weather watchers say it's always rare for two hurricanes to hit so close together, even more so in Hawaii. Andrew Friedman is a senior climate reporter with Mashable. I asked him where these two storm systems originated.
Well, they both formed in the eastern Pacific Ocean, where water temperatures are extremely warm for this time of year right now. So they both formed off the west coast of Mexico, between the west coast of Mexico and Hawaii. And right now, the first one, the first threat is Hurricane Izelle, which is about 800 miles east of Hilo, Hawaii, at this point, and is tracking west-northwestward towards the islands. While Julio, which remains a minimal hurricane, is close behind.
And yet, hurricanes actually hitting the Hawaiian Islands are apparently rare, much rarer than the hurricane systems here on the East Coast. Why is that?
Yeah, you might think that Hawaii, because it is out there in the middle of the Pacific, and you know the Pacific is a very active region for tropical systems, that these storms would be more frequent. But actually, Hawaii is strangely, through quirks of the ocean and atmosphere, relatively protected from these storms normally. The water temperatures as you approach the islands, if a storm is approaching from the east, the water temperatures cool off pretty significantly as you get toward the islands. So that weakens the storm. Also, you tend to have faster winds in the atmosphere near Hawaii and points northward. And that can create wind shear, which kind of tears apart the thunderstorms that form the core of a hurricane.
And this is two hurricanes at once. Will they hit landfall at once? And even if they don't, is there some unprecedented weather dynamic that two hurricanes set up?
Well, it would be unprecedented if two hurricanes were to hit in the same week. It would also be unprecedented if two tropical storms hit within less than 10 days of each other. That looks more likely. It's likely that both of these storms will weaken to be tropical storms or minimal hurricanes when they approach the islands. The bigger threat is the first one, which is Izelle, which is likely to pass over or near the Big Island of Hawaii at about Thursday evening local time.
What is the right lingo for these storms, Andrew, since it's the Pacific? Are these typhoons or do you call them hurricanes?
No, there are. So in the Eastern Pacific and Central Pacific, they are still called hurricanes. And when they weaken a little bit, they're called tropical storms. It's not until you get into the Western Pacific where you have typhoons, and that becomes more confusing because right now we have a typhoon that is headed towards landfall in southern Japan. And southern Japan has had a couple of these storms so far this year, and there's a big danger of mudslides there. So it's a little tough talking about these in the same story because they're the same type of storms. They're just called different things in different parts of the world.
Andrew Friedman, senior climate reporter with Mashable, thank you very much for explaining this to us.
Thank you for having me anytime.
Now to the gathering storm of war of old. This week there have been a lot of remembrances, especially in Europe, recalling the start of World War I 100 years ago. But we've got a story for you now that will transport you back to those war-torn years a century ago. It comes to us from Sam Sweeney. He's a professional fiddler in England who made a discovery a few years ago after he went shopping for a new fiddle for his collection. You know what? I can't possibly do this story justice. So here's Sam Sweeney himself to tell his amazing musical tale.
Back in 2008, I'd just left school and I was on the search for a new fiddle, a new lovely instrument to play. So I went to a man called Roger Claridge. I went to his violin shop in Oxford and I played about 30 or 40 violins in his shop. And in the end, I decided I'd fallen in love with this instrument. It was completely brand new, had no marks of being played at all, and it, you know, smelled of varnish. And I took it home that night to really play it properly, and I looked inside the F-hole of the violin, and on the inside it said it was made by Richard S. Howard in Hare Hills, Leeds, 1915. And there was another sticker inside that said made in the Great War with a little sketch of some flags on it. So I thought to myself, well, how is it possible that this fiddle was made in 1915 if it's completely brand new? So my dad, who's a very keen genealogist, and myself, we sort of set about researching the story, and we found Richard Howard. We found the fella who made the violin in the 1901 census, listed as a stonemason. And then 10 years later, in the 1911 census, he was listed as a music hall performer. So he wasn't a professional violin maker, but music was his profession. The guy who put the fiddle together in 2008, he had acquired these pieces carved by Richard Howard in 1915, but the fiddle had never been fully assembled because in 1916, Richard joined the British Army and went off to Flanders and left all the carved pieces of this violin in his workshop in Leeds. And unfortunately, the man who carved my violin, he died at the Battle of Messines Ridge, which was an enormous battle and actually considered to be a huge victory for the Allied forces. Last month, I was fortunate enough to be able to go to Belgium to visit Richard's grave, and I took the fiddle that he never got to finish to his gravestone, and I played his fiddle to him. I just played him a few tunes that I love, but I also played him his regimental march. When he joined the army, he was in the Duke of Wellington's West Riding Regiment, and their regimental march is called the Wellesley. And it, actually, that theme provides an enormous amount of the material, the musical material for the show, so I played him his regimental march because it would have been a piece of music that he heard on an almost daily basis when he was in the army. It sort of felt like the whole story came full circle at that point.
What a lovely tale. That was professional fiddler Sam Sweeney, who told that wonderful story to our friends over at the BBC. Sam and his fiddle get the mic drop today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. As always, thanks for listening.
The world. World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org, by the Ford Foundation, by PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, MacFound.org, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation, and by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at Carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.